beginning, it should say.
So good afternoon, everybody. This is Alan Hackney speaking. It's 1 o'clock, and welcome to the October Health IT Advisory Council meeting. I see that we have some of our advisors still joining, so we will stand by for a few minutes and we'll be back to you shortly.
Guess we're going to be mute for a while.
Again, good afternoon. This is Alan speaking. We are waiting for just a couple more folks to get to quorum. We'll be starting any moment now.
Hi, good afternoon, Alan. This is SB. Read your article today in the Connecticut Mirror.
Thank you, SB. Okay, I have 5 minutes after one, and I think we'll call the Health IT Advisory Council to order. Tina, if we roll forward. We have an interesting agenda, I hope, for folks today. A bit of an update on Connie, as we usually do. And then some discussion around some policy changes that are relevant to the work that we do from the federal agencies. And further discussion on the statewide five-year health IT plan. And then some discussion around another initiative focused on primary care in Connecticut. So it should be a very interesting at this point, Tina, if we roll forward, and I'll ask you to take a roll.
Thank you, Alan. Good afternoon, everyone. Just for the record, please announce that you're here when I call your name. Alan Hackney.
I'm here.
Dr. Caranto.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm here.
Good afternoon. Joe Stanford.
Here.
Liz Taylor. Cindy Butterfield. Cheryl Sepulak. Ted Doolittle. Stacy Beck. Rob Rue.
Hi, I'm here.
Hello. Dave Fusco. Nick Scabelli. Pat Checo. Lisa Stump. Vanessa Hinton.
Vanessa Hinton here.
Afternoon. Dennis Mitchell. Dr. Pettit. Mark Raymond.
Hi, Tina. I'm here.
Hi, Mark. Sandra Kunis.
Good afternoon. I'm here.
Good afternoon. Kim Martone.
Hi, Tina. Here.
Hi, Kim. Jeanette De Jesus, Rob Blundo, Pat Charmel.
Yeah, I'm here, Tina. Thanks.
Hi, Dr. K. Dina Berlin. I have you counted, Dina. I see that you responded to the chat. Takesha Everett.
Hi, this is Takesha. I'm present.
Hello. Cassandra Murphy.
Hi, I'm here.
Hi. Chuck Podesta.
I'm here.
And Ken Ferrucci. Okay. Is there anyone that I missed?
Hi, it's Lisa Stump. I'm here.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you.
And this
and
is
sorry, Ted. There was one more.
Doolittle.
Hi, Ted. Thank you. All right. Fantastic. We're at quorum.
Okay, thank you very much, Tina. So this, just as a reminder, under the pandemic executive orders, this meeting is being recorded and will be placed onto the OHS website in just a few days. We will call for public comment in a moment, and folks that have an interest in making comment may do so thereafter. Folks will be placed on mute. Except for the advisors. Lastly, just a reminder to the advisors that because of this is being recorded, we just ask that people say their name as they are asking a question or responding to one. So with that, I will ask if there is any public comment. For members of the public who may have audio challenges, we do invite you to use the chat feature if that's available to you. All Okay, I'm hearing none. So Tina, let's roll forward. At this point, I'll ask for a motion from the advisors to approve the minutes from our September meeting.
Smart Raymond, so moved.
Thank you, Mark. Is there a second?
Vanessa,
second. Everett.
I think Vanessa just snuck in. Vanessa, thank you for that. Is there any improvements, adjustments, corrections? Hearing none, I will ask all the advisors to say aye if they approve.
Aye.
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 Thank you for that. Are there any nays? And are there any abstentions? Thank you, my advisors. The minutes are approved. Tina, shall we roll forward? At this time, I'm going to ask a familiar person to come back and visit us for an update on Connie. So, Michael, it's over to you.
Thank you very much, Alan, and good to kind of sort of see all of you again. I am coming back now, as you know, in my role as interim executive director. And I must say, I thoroughly enjoyed my 3 years working as a consultant with Cedar Bridge in support of the Health IT Advisory Council and the Office of Health Strategy. And it's just an extraordinary opportunity that not many people have to then come back and join a management team of an organization that was incubated and planned for from the policy and strategy side. I have a number of updates today, and I hope what comes across is the sense of urgency and sense of purpose that we have on the management team to make this thing come alive and fulfill the dreams and aspirations that all of you have had for a number of years now. So let me get on with a number of important updates. First, I'm very pleased to announce that we have selected our integration partner. The board has approved CRISP. CRISP is one of the leading HIEs in the US. They support currently HIEs in Maryland and West Virginia and DC in a fashion very similar to what we have engineered and designed for support for Connie. We'll be providing technology and services, being able to leverage the extensive toolbox that they have built over the years and brought value to the stakeholders in their various communities. David Horrocks is their CEO. I've known personally David for years. I've known the organization for years and have full confidence in their capabilities. Mike Banfield is the key executive who's on point for leading the charge for CRISP and supporting Connie. And Mike and his wife only recently moved to Connecticut. His wife is a physician who works at one of the community health centers in Connecticut. So we have a local support as well as a deeply experienced support on that. So CRISP, you'll be hearing lots more about in the coming months. Second item would be progress on our security assessment. You heard last month that Yale, on behalf of many of the hospitals across the state, has taken on a rigorous assessment process to look at the security of the technology of Connie, and CRISP is participating in that. My hat is off to Glenn Stanton, who is part of Lisa's team. Glenn has brought his work group in the security area through a process to take a good hard look at way the technology is to be operated and structured. He's gotten input from hospitals across the state, and our target is to finalize that security assessment this month, and all things look like they're pointed in a very positive direction for us to be able to accomplish that. And at that point, the results will certainly be communicated to other hospitals who have deferred a lot of that heavy lift to Glenn and his team at Yale New Haven. On the contract status side, the kind of contract with OHS is substantially finalized. I'd like to thank the OHS team for their collaboration and their spirit of cooperation in that process. We are still waiting for the completion of MOA 4 to finalize the contract process. Once that is done, then truly it's full speed ahead on all fronts. We'll have the funding in place and the mandate to be able to move a number of important initiatives forward. And that would include the provision of technical assistance funds to participants and beginning the technical onboarding process. Fourth area to provide an update is on the prescription data monitoring program in conjunction with the Support Act funding. We've had a number of productive discussions with Rod Marriott and his team at the Department of Consumer Protection. Rod actually did a wonderful presentation to the September Operations Advisory Committee, and we had a lively discussion around opportunities and synergies created from the intersection of HIE and EDMP. We are beginning to identify some specific areas that we may want to pursue, and you'll be hearing about that in the coming months. The fifth area is a participants update. Not sure how many were on the list at the last meeting, but we have five trust agreements signed called QDSOA, Qualified Data Sharing Organization Agreements. We have the Connecticut State Medical Society and their HIE initiative called CT Health Link. They were the very first signers back in May. We have Community Health Network, ProHealth, an organization familiar with many of you, CMG, and Remedy / Signify. We also have them in place. And as a reminder, the QDSOAs are the initial legal onboarding mechanism. That's the first step in the process. We're working with a number of other orgs to onboard them legally, but through the signature of the trust agreement. And then that will be followed by technical onboarding. Part of our work with our new integration partner is to plan for and begin the technical onboarding process. Next up is a bit of exciting news. Notice was received on October 7th that the IRS has granted CONI its not-for-profit 501c3 status. And there were no questions from IRS, and that's a bit unusual. If anyone has gone through that process, it can be quite extensive and challenging to get through, but we're very pleased that IRS recognized the public good nature and benefit of CONI. We continue to fill out the some of the organizational infrastructure. Just a couple of weeks ago, the board did select our auditor, and this was an RFQ process led by the Finance and Auditing Committee, and we have selected Marcum. Some of you probably, I know some of the board members know Marcum. They are headquartered in New York City, the 16th largest firm in the U.S. We got to speak with the two partners, two principals from Marcum, who will be supporting CONI, and they are Frank Maselli and Megan Budd. Both of them and the firm are deeply experienced in healthcare, not-for-profits, and state and federal contracting. And what I think really impressed the Finance and Audit Committee is their understanding of what it takes to bring forth an organization into existence and have proper accounting systems, internal controls and the like built into the infrastructure from day one. And so they'll be assisting on the front end as well as auditing, of course, on the back end. The final piece that I have is to give you an update on the executive director search process. This is a national search process overseen by the Executive Director Search Committee. One of your council members, Mark Raymond, chairs that group. Support from Markham has been extensive. It is the same Markham as the auditing firm, but of course a completely separate division. The search committee has selected a final candidate, and we're working through final terms of that agreement, and we would hope to make a formal announcement within a couple of weeks on that. So lots going on, to say the least. I hope what you can see from this is that what most HIEs and those who study HIEs would consider critical success factors, those are either in place or almost fully in place. I've got to know the board through my time since August, and has a really high performing board, incredible dedication. People are spending time not just at board meetings, but also in committee meetings, both ad hoc, like the ED Search Committee, but also in the standing committees like Finance and Audit. The management team will get, of course, added to significantly when the permanent executive director comes on board. But I also want to make mention of what an incredible resource Connie has in Michelle Pulick, who is our operations lead. Michelle's that critical person who sometimes stays in the background, but her breadth and depth of work in support of Connie, it has certainly made my job possible, and also is just critical to the organization moving forward. We have our integration partner in place. We continue to get outstanding support from Velatora. We've got our initial signers to the trust agreement. Anybody who's ever built an HIE says that the first five signers are to trust agreements are harder than the next 50. And I'm looking forward to getting the next 50 on board. I mentioned the security audit. Funding will continue to be in place once we get all the contracts. So I have put the pressure on myself and others by saying that we've got projected in front of us a hockey stick growth curve. What you're seeing is the inglorious kind of work that's necessary for success. But in terms of actual growth, that's what will be realized over the next quarter and then fully in 2021. So I'm very pleased with where we are and very excited about where we're going. And I would be happy to take any questions from the council members.
That was a very robust update, Michael. Thank you very much. A lot going on. I would open it up to the advisors now for any questions they might have.
Hi, Alan. I just wanted to congratulate you and Michael. I think the progress that has been made in the last couple of months to get key infrastructure in place with CRISP, to start to put into place key roles on the executive team at Connie, just are building incredible momentum. Having been a part of this for a number of years now, it is really exciting to see it all coming together in a really exciting way. So I just want to note that for the record, congratulate and thank you both.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa. I'll return the compliment. You know, aside from all the work on the board or on the HID Advisory Council, I think Mark Raymond and Lisa Stomp and Pat Charmel are doing double duty and in some cases triple duty to try to bring Connie forward. And along with the other members of the board, it's very gratifying to see this coming to fruition. So thank you all for that. Other questions for Michael?
Hi, this is Takesha, and I am, thank you, Michael, for the presentation. I'm wondering, as we move forward, and at some point I'm sure this body will know who the permanent executive director will be, if we're able to, and I'm not asking for this today, but to get a sense of the diversity mix within the candidate pool for the final candidates. I'm just curious to know kind of who showed up and what were the criteria related to selecting that person. Again, not expecting the answer today, but hopeful that we can have that information at some point.
Thank you. And when the appropriate time is, perhaps Mark Raymond, who chaired the search committee, can lead that part of the information sharing. So thank you.
There are other questions for Michael? All right, Michael, thank you for bringing us up to date and sharing all the good work the team's doing. Tina, shall we move forward? Okay, at this point, I would like to introduce Kate Kiefert. She is consulting with Cedar Bridge on a number of policy issues. I know Kate from a variety of roles that she's played for the Office of the National Coordinator and for the NESCO organization and other places. So very knowledgeable person, and she's going to share some information around changes that are occurring at the federal level. So Kate, welcome to the meeting.
Great. Thank you so much. Can you all hear me okay?
We can.
Yep.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you very much. So I've been contracting with Cedar Bridge to support Connecticut and some of the health IT and HIE activities. One thing we wanted to inform everyone was just to give a high level of some federal policies that are impacting payers, providers, health information exchanges, health information networks, and just to give the context to show which of these policies and what some of your different constituencies that you all represent might be concerned about in the next couple of years. Excuse me. The first one that we're going to go through, just as a high level overview of the different policies. We're going to speak to the CMS interoperability and patient access rule. We'll also touch on briefly the ONC 21st Century Cures final rule. We also talk about a couple of payment models and some requirements for health information exchange and reporting. And then there at the end of this, we also do have some information around some public health reporting requirements around COVID for testing as well as for vaccinations, and then also in the CARES Act, an update around 42 CFR Part 2. Those will just be at the end as an FYI. And I think the intent of this is just to show that there are definitely some things happening at a national level that this group should be aware of, but also be aware of that providers, payers, Medicaid, a lot of folks are really starting to strategize different approaches to these things. All right. So next slide should be the CMS interoperability and patient access rule. This one was really is focused around enabling better patient access to their health information, improving interoperability for an innovation, and then also reducing burden on payers and providers. Different parts of this rule are impacting different entities. So when there's a point in the next couple of slides where I say CMS regulated payers, that's going to be Medicare, Advantage organizations, Medicaid, fee-for-service, managed care, CHIP, qualified health plans are on the federal exchanges. Also promoting interoperability providers and any of those providers that might be part of the promoting interoperability program. And then hospitals, anytime I say hospitals, it's going to be including critical access hospitals or psychiatric hospitals. Next slide, please. There are kind of seven main policies around the CMS interoperability rule, and I put them in order of when the by their compliance date. And due to COVID-19, some of the enforcement dates were extended for a few months because originally everything was supposed to happen as of when the final rules dropped in March of 2020, but they did extend these due to COVID-19 circumstances. So the first policy speaks to public reporting and information blocking. And this is just basically saying by the end of 2020, CMS is going to publicly report any eligible clinicians or hospitals or that might be information blocking based on how they've attested to certain promoting interoperability program requirements. So this is based on their 2019 data. So basically they're information blocking and not sharing information, or there's been a complaint or the different things, or they haven't attested, they're going to publicly put that on their website. The next one is around digital contact information, and this is going to impact providers. So CMS are going to publicly report providers who do not list or update their digital contact information in the NPES system, the National Plan and Provider Enumeration System. And they're going to have to include the digital contact information, such as secure digital endpoints, like a direct address or any FHIR API endpoints. And providers are going to have to do this by the end of late 2020. That's also going to be important because there's going to be some complementary or kind of intersecting rules, and just really having that provider information, especially that digital information, updated in a central place is going to be important. And that's also potentially an available way for providers in Connecticut to make sure all their access is, or the information is updated. The next one, the yellow one, speaks to the admission discharge transfer event notifications. This is important because there's a lot of states that are trying to address this requirement collectively as a group with public and private partnerships. But basically, for this one, hospitals, this includes psychiatric hospitals and critical access hospitals, there's going to be a requirement for a condition of participation in Medicare around having the ability for an electronic patient event notification, or their ADTs, their admission, discharge, or transfers to another healthcare facility or to another community provider. And they're going to have to be able to demonstrate that they can electronically share those ADT notifications to another provider by May 1st of 2021. This is a place where Connie or other technical services could enable this to happen. I think there's a lot of different approaches, but as a condition to participation for Medicare, this is going to be a really important thing that the hospitals are considering and how to implement this. Other states, again, are saying, you know, what can be done at a community level or a state level versus what do they have to do individually? And I think that there's a lot of alignment opportunities, especially around specific data requirements and how folks will approach that. Next slide, please. This one, these speak to, is going to be a little bit into 2021 and later. But these are going to, the first one here speaks to the patient access API. And this is going to be important for CMS regulated payers. That's going to be your Medicaid, managed care, CHIP, fee for service, plus any of the health plans that are on the federal exchange. But they're going to be required to be able to implement and maintain standards-based, and it's a very specific HL7 FHIR release 4.0.1, and make sure that patients are easily able to access their claims and encounter information, including cost and a subset of their clinical information through a third party of their choice. That is by January 1st of 2021. I also wanted to point out the standards with this because later on there, you all are going to be hearing about some of the statewide data strategy, and there's a lot of specific requirements there around standards. So there's an opportunity to identify the standards that they pulled out into this rule and make sure that they align to where Connecticut is going and where Connie is reaching as well, and just making sure that all of those standards requirements are proliferate from the federal level to the state level to Connie to the provider and operational level as well. The next one speaks to the provider directory. And this is going to be impacting Medicare Advantage organizations, fee-for-service, CHIP, and CHIP managed care entities, all of those specific payers we discussed. But this is going to be that there's going to be required to make a provider directory information available via API. And this API must be accessible via a public-facing digital endpoint form on the payer's website. I think this is going to be important. And this is by January 1st of 2021. This goes to the other rule around updating it at the national level data registry at the NPES, but having on that provider directory information available publicly through API is going to help the availability to for sharing information with those providers and just keep that information up to date. The next one speaks to a payer-to-payer exchange. Again, this speaks to the CMS-regulated payers. And what is required here is that there's going to be a requirement by January 1st of 2022 to exchange certain patient clinical information that's specific to the US CDI, which is the US Core Data for Interoperability version, Data 1 set, at the patient's request and be able to allow the patient to request that information shared from payer to payer. So if they move their coverage from payer one to payer two, that they are able to share that information, the cumulative health record from payer to payer. So that's going to be an interesting way to strategize how to solution that. The US CDI, again, is one of those really key standards that should be thought about of how to proliferate that and how those are going to be adjusted to in Connecticut. And I have a slide later on that is going to speak to that. And the last one is around, it's going to focus more on dual eligibles and it's going to impact the state Medicaid agency, but this is improving the dual eligible experience. And they're going to have to increase the frequency of the federal and state data exchanges of enrollee data. Previously, they were able to share and report this up monthly, but now they're going to have to go to a daily exchange by April 1st of 2022. So that's the very high level, fairly quick CMS interoperability rule, but it does show that there's a wide range of impact to different stakeholders in Connecticut. Next slide, please. So the CMS interoperability rule and the ONC 21st Century Cures Act rule are kind of related. A lot of times you've seen the CMS interoperability rule point to the ONC rule. ONC is going to be mainly focusing on responsibilities for health IT developers, HIEs, HIMs, healthcare providers, and it really focuses on definition around information blocking. They define who are the health IT actors. They define electronic health information networks, health information exchanges. What does it mean to interfere with, access, or exchange that? And they also have a very specific exception structure. It's going to be a requirement around attesting to that and saying that people are not information blocking, but that it's going to be a specific process around information blocking and following and making sure that there isn't a provider or a technical vendor or anyone who is actually inhibiting the flow of electronic information. The second part speaks to the ONC Health IT Certification Program. This is ensuring that any health IT developer that's going to be putting and getting their technology certified, that they can meet all the requirements for electronic health information exports, and they also are going to have to meet FHIR standard API for patient and the population level data. They're going to have to meet those requirements to be certified. And there's also very specific conditions and maintenance of certification requirements that they're going to have to be able to meet. And that's going to be important to make sure that there's the technology is keeping up with the changing standards and the expectations of what that technology is going to have to do. The third talks to the US CDI that we spoke about before, and that's talking that it replaced the a common clinical data set. And they've identified some additional data elements that should be able to be exchanged by health IT technical services. They also right now have an update where people can add additional data elements into that. So that would be requiring the health IT developers to be able to be shared. A lot of the folks that are submitting data element recommendations to the US CDI are submitting things around social determinants of health, surveys, other types of data elements that are going to address kind of the non-health, broader social risk and social determinants of health side. Next slide, please. I won't go through these, but I want to make sure that we leave enough time for any questions. But this one speaks to the information blocking. It's going to be important because there will be fines and potentially loss of certification if a health IT developer or other defined or the other actors are determined that you are information blocking. The covered actors, I do want to point out that the covered actors could include healthcare providers, health IT developers of certified products, and then health information exchanges and health information exchange networks. That might be some of those national level networks. So it's just definitely something to consider, and there's definitely going to be an operational process around that. Next slide, please. This one is speaking around the electronic health information export certification criteria with requirements around single patient EHI export and then patient population EHI export. And I think that's important to point out, especially for any broader analytics that might be done versus what needs to be done at an individual level. There are requirements around standards and formats, image data, time frame, and direct-to-patient functionality. Next slide, please. The next slide speaks to the FHIR standard for application programming interfaces, or APIs. This is important because this speaks to very specific standards, and I think that this is an opportunity to align some of the Connecticut standards to the national ones. Talk about FHIR Release 4 and the USCDI, and then and how those need to be a certified API technology and what two types of API-enabled services are required. So it's just something to consider in the different planning and investment areas. This next slide, speaks to the USCDI. And again, this is where they replaced the common clinical data set with the USCDI as a minimum data classes to improve the flow of electronic health information to help ensure that the information can be effectively understood when it is received. At the time of this final rule being published in March, it did have these different data elements and data classes specified, all the way from clinical notes, progress notes, to provenance of where did the data originate, some specific vital signs. You can actually see here that there are some that are noted as new. They are accepting new data elements and data classes. And I think that the proposed data element submission process is going to be closed in early November. So I suspect that this USCDI will be updated in the next few months based on their approval process. So that's been the CMS and ONC rules to show how there are some connection points, but these are important things to point out from a data standards perspective, as well as some required capabilities that need to be enabled for different actors. The next slide speaks to some specific payment models. So this got the Medicare level, but they in multiple CMS rules. They're calling out interoperability and data use and payment program participation and rules, anywhere from like the CMS, ACO, Medicare Shared Savings Program, a lot of the requirements for quality reporting for promoting interoperability. There also has very specific requirements in the, it's called the IPPS rule or the Inpatient Prospective Payment System and Long-Term Acute Care Hospital Final Rule. They have very specific measures around interoperability. And if you go to the next slide, it speaks to some of those requirements or around e-prescribing, querying of the PDMP as a bonus measure, health information exchange, including electronic referral loops, and then by sending information, but also that closed loop by receiving and reconciling that health information. There's a provider to patient exchange, very similar to that's in the CMS interoperability rule. And there are also some public health and clinical data exchange reporting measures that folks can use as some of their quality metrics. Everywhere from syndromic surveillance reporting, immunizations, electronic case reporting, public health registry reporting, clinical data, and EOR reporting. The next slide speaks to, and I know these are a lot of federal policies, and hopefully that these are not, it is a little overwhelming, but it is just good to see what the landscape is and just make sure that you're aware of these things coming down. This slide on public health reporting requirements wanted to point out that there are around COVID-19, that there are some pandemic response and laboratory data reporting that is expanding required data elements to be collected at order entry and assessment collection and when results are reported into public health. And these additional data elements are focused a lot around the data demographics, so with race and ethnicity, but also around some other patient data that might be helpful in any case investigations or any epidemiology activities. There are specific data reporting and transmission requirements, and then some EHR requirements as well. The second one came out recently, but it does have some some requirements. They put a proposed rule out and they just finalized it, but the next one speaks to a requirement for hospitals, hospital labs, and acute care facility data reporting to HHS. And they are required to report capacity and utilization data, flu condition reporting, which is similar to syndromic surveillance, testing data if they use an in-house laboratory, reporting and transmission requirements. And one thing here I wanted to point out is conditions of participation in Medicare, if they don't comply with those requirements within 14 weeks, they are at risk for as a condition of participation with Medicare and Medicaid. So I think that there's definitely going to be a lot of these settings that are going to be looking at these and seeing what are some ways to enable the data reporting and maybe get some of the burden off of the setting. So hopefully this has been informational on a lot of things coming down from the feds that folks might need to be aware of. I think the last slide just speaks to within the CARES Act, there was an update to 42 CFR Part 2 to help facilitate better care coordination of care. And they have some specific SAMHSA worked, and they have up to 12 months, but SAMHSA did release some updated rules on how to share 42 CFR Part 2 data, and they released that in August. So I just know that for any of that sensitive health information from behavioral health or substance use disorder facilities, that this is there are some updates and changes, and there might be some opportunities to enable that data to be shared across settings. That is all I had. I'll pass it back over to you, Ellen, and see if you want to open up for questions or if anybody, or I don't sure if I need to pass it to someone in Cedar Bridge, but I'll let Ellen let me know what I need to do next.
Oh, hey, thank you for that. And I feel like I just been washed over by an interoperability tsunami. At this point, I think we'll open it up to the advisors to see if they have comments or questions. I'm just reminding the advisors you may be on mute.
Yeah, Alan, thanks. It took me a second to get off. I appreciate that. It's Mark Raymond. The does this in, you know, do a lot of these changes in any way, you know, how do you see them either escalating, changing, delaying some of the sort of initial use cases or activities that, you know, we lined up and recommended for Connie?
That's probably better for Michael or myself. You know, as we've been looking at this, the initial use cases largely align already to what's being proposed here. A lot of these things apply to caregiving settings separate from whether they're flowing into or out of the HIE. But I think there's a few places that touch things quite directly. One of the ones is this very last one that Kate's got on the screen right now. Embedded in the CARES Act is actually some changes to consent requirements for sharing information for certain behavioral health conditions. And it still requires positive consent to be able to share behavioral health. However, once that positive consent is given, it reverts to a more traditional HIPAA relationship for data sharing. And that's very important for anybody who's treating folks who may have behavioral health conditions, whether substance use or other types of issues. I think the issue on information blocking is another one that we're very concerned about. We've discussed this concept of information blocking as we've been working through the legal agreements for participation in the HIE, and we're very the legal documents are very clear around adhering to both the letter and the spirit of what the interoperability rule is all about. And then just looking out longer term, there may be some real opportunities for the HIE to support patient access through these APIs that are being developed with the new interoperability rules that could really make it a lot easier for patients to be better stewards of their own health data. So those are just three comments right off the top of my head. Michael, is there anything you might want to add on to that?
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate the question, Mark. Not so specifically on the use cases themselves. I think those would be straightforward ways of information sharing. It would be around the policy and practice. The bar is actually a bit higher for the HIEs than it is for providers, because for providers, it's whether the provider knows that the information blocking practice is occurring. For HIEs, it's whether the HIE knows or should have known that information blocking is being done in practice. So no doubt we'll have a policy foundation that codifies what we have in the way of support for information blocking compliance. As Alan suggested, we'll be baking that into some of our participation agreement requirements and that sort of thing. Where it gets HIEs into trouble would be where there's discriminatory practices around setting of fees in a way that discriminates against some parties getting information but not other parties and that sort of thing, or hardwiring efficiencies and some parties getting information versus others. So it's something that we will study, both the impact on the HIE itself as well as the impact on our providers, and we would anticipate working very closely with our providers, not just on our own compliance, but enabling their compliance as well.
Great. Thank you both.
Yes, sir.
Other questions from the advisors? I know it's a lot to digest.
There was something in the chat from Dina. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Just wanted to draw your attention to Dina's question in the chat.
Dina is proud to point out that Connecticut had the first information blocking law in the country, and that the question to Kate is, does the federal law preempt state laws?
No, I don't know how to answer that. What was the Connecticut law?
Connecticut had a law around effectively information blocking between health organizations. It's been on the books for a few years now.
Yeah. No, I think that the difference, I don't think that it would preempt that, but that what can be done at a federal level around information blocking is they're going to have specific investigation processes and penalties that I think that's going to be where there's going to be an opportunity of what the federal law will be able to undertake. So even if there's issues at the, you know, if something's reported to Connecticut around information blocking at the federal level, there could be additional financial penalties around it as well. So I think that's more complementary than superseding.
All right. It's an interesting question, and Dina's challenged by having a lack of audio on her computer, but she's noting the statute reference in the chat and that it's an unfair trade practice in Connecticut. I think for the HIE team, it's worth taking back just to get a clear answer to Dina on that. So, Dina, thank you for chatting your question. Other advisors? All right, Kate, I'm not hearing any more. So I thank you for pulling all this together. It's an awful lot of information, and you know, that's going to affect all of us. So thank you for that. And Tina, let us move on. Okay, at this point, we'd like to give the advisors a bit of an update on the five-year HIT plan that was introduced last month. I believe we're going to have a pinch hitter for Beth Sala. I'll turn it over to Cedarbridge.
Hi, everyone. Carol Robinson with Cedarbridge Group. And we apologize. I was really looking forward to introducing Fatsala Pathy, who has joined Cedarbridge recently as a senior director, to you. But unfortunately, she is en route to visit her daughter in college and felt like it might not be the best audio for her to present today. So I am stepping in and pinch hitting, as Alan said, and we'll take you through a little bit more planning than you heard last month about the health IT planning process, and then would be happy to answer questions, and I'm sure we'll have Vatsala presenting to you in coming months and meetings, because she will be the Cedarbridge consultant leading the HIT planning process. And Terry Beckett and myself and lots of familiar faces will continue to be behind the scenes on this, but I will guarantee you'll be in great hands with Vatsala. So if you wanna go forward, Tina. So you saw this slide in September, if you were able to attend the meeting. And the important thing here is that we have a very defined process for developing roadmaps or plans for states in thinking about statewide health IT and HIE strategies and tactics to span a period of time. Typically, these are being developed around the country in five-year timeframes, approximately. So the planning process is anticipated to take somewhere between now and the end of fiscal year 2021, September. I am hopeful that we'll move that up a little bit because I think that there's some really important factors that will advance Connie's work and HIE adoption across a variety of types of stakeholders. And so we hope to, you know, speed this process a little bit, but it's also very important that we are thorough and that we really listen and understand where the pain points, where the specific needs and barriers and challenges may be for various nodes on a statewide network. So I'm going to walk you through the process here a little bit, if you want to go to the next slide. Cedarbridge does this kind of planning work across the country. Right now, we're engaged in a couple of other states, somewhere along the the continuum of developing a plan and implementing plans. And with Connecticut, we have an advantage of having conducted a pretty robust environmental scan in the spring of 2017, as many of you may remember. Now, moving to 3.5 years later and really thinking about the need for understanding how the environment has changed, we also are facing the challenges of doing this in a pandemic. So you won't see the kind of in-person gatherings at least until late in the planning process or delivery process. So that has required Cedar Bridge to really think about how to engage and discover in more creative ways. The key informant interviews of individuals and small groups, what we do with some semi-structured interviews, can still be done very easily in virtual context. And we've all learned much, much more in the last 6 months about virtual meetings than we all thought we probably would have in the years prior to that. But we're very confident that key informant interviews can be conducted in really effective ways now. And with video, I am encouraged that we can do more small group interviews and engage small but aligned groups of key informants in ways that in the past were more difficult to do by phone. We also have developed some very specific electronic surveys that we work to disseminate across states through associations and affiliation groups, where they basically serve as our conduit, as our partner in engaging their membership to participate in electronic surveys. This has helped us to increase the response rates to our surveys to a large degree, and really to engage more varieties of stakeholders. For example, in Michigan right now, we have disseminated surveys in 7 specific domains. We are have engaged upwards of 50 different associations to help us disseminate those. And so organizations that typically have not had as much of a voice in explaining their needs and their priorities and their barriers and challenges in terms of using health IT and engaging in information exchange, whether that is health related or social service related, justice system, education, and early childhood and others. Those are now through this electronic survey methodology that we've developed, are really able to be broadly expanded. And we've sent surveys to just numbers of emergency medical services providers and associations, which we're really interested in understanding more in terms of EMS, particularly with the pandemic. So that's just one example. We also use interactive webinars in different ways than we have in the past. We have just completed 8 interactive webinars in Michigan and are starting another series of 8. These are designed around domain-specific topics, and we use breakout rooms and raise your hand and emotion kind emoji kind of plus 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 when somebody else makes a comment that you like, and those kinds of feedback that actually does give us more quantitative kind of data to build a plan across. And then bi-directional opportunities for engagement throughout the discovery process. We are always happy to present to groups and organizational board meetings, and our partners, of course, at OHS would be the appropriate people to be leading those as well. So that's just a little bit about our process. We'll go on and talk about how we take that information and then analyze it and synthesize it. We collect our information through these planning processes in two broad buckets. One is the current state. When we think about that in terms of organizational adoption and use of information technology and information exchange modalities, we then look at interagency data sharing. We look at system functionality, the interoperability of the systems, and the interoperability of the data within the systems. And that could include demographic data, for example. We look at governance and sustainability and accountability processes in a current state framework. And then we ask our stakeholders to describe their desired future state of availability of information technology functionality, what kinds of data needs that they have to or would like to have data around to manage their programs better and to deliver their services better. And from those two, we then pull all that information together when we conduct a gap analysis. And the gap analysis really gives us some qualitative information and quantitative information to be able to develop a set of recommendations. And those recommendations then really come to you and to OHS. And so, Tina, if you move to the next slide, some potential areas where, topic areas where we might see recommendations for Connecticut to move forward with a five-year health IT plan would be around looking at use case priorities. There has been a lot of work in Connecticut around use case priorities, and now we have the great news about CRISP being selected as the technology provider for Connie. We're thrilled about that, and we know that CRISP has incredible experience in Maryland and other states that they support for implementing various use cases. So prioritizing those based on the information that we've collected in this environmental scan will be, I think, very helpful for the CONI board and the committees, and also very helpful for state agencies across Health and Human Services. We look at standards and we talk about infrastructure in terms of diffuse infrastructure and shared services infrastructure, and looking at standards around both of those. We'll work very closely with the work that Scott Gall is doing around a state health data plan for Connecticut, and of course the work that Mark Raymond and his organization are doing to both guided by the General Assembly's statute as well as this plan is. And so aligning those are really critical. And so standards will be a big deal in Connecticut, and we're glad to see that. Funding requirements, funding timelines, sustainability strategies, communication and education, the technical assistance that organizations need to be able to implement technology and use it effectively. There's oftentimes regulatory and legislative needs, and there's also management or contractual strategies that could be put in place that would accelerate the use and effectiveness of health IT plans. Monitoring and measuring that accountability piece, and then governance to assist in continued success of the new strategies that are put forth. And if you go to the next slide, so phase four is really about making sure that all of the rowboats in the water are pulling their oars in the same direction. So once the recommendations have been brought forward to this council and a steering committee or other types of work groups or little tiger teams, however the OHS and HITECH determined the best way to help create that oversight of our work, we want to make sure that we are then presenting information that is directionally correct for what we've heard. Do we hear things that that were said to us effectively? Did we then synthesize those and analyze those in ways that make sense for Connecticut? And so that we flip the what we call stakeholder input to become stakeholder feedback, and in this process, in the phase four process, so that if there need to be revisions to the recommendations, that those occur before a plan is released as final. And if those revisions are needed or requested across the ecosystem in Connecticut, that those are then brought forward to the Health IT Council and OHS leadership to consider, and then they determine what is adopted, and then we move forward with finalization. And so finally, the final slide, Tina, if you could just go to that for this presentation, is really around the project management, that accountability that I've spoken to, meaning the accountability of our work, CedarBridge work, to deliver that in ways that are most useful to the stakeholders and the leadership in Connecticut and the oversight of our work. We will work closely with OHS, Sean Fogarty, Alan Hackney, Vicky Veltri, and all the great people that are part of the OHS team will be hearing from us regularly, and so will you. So more to come. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Carol. And I invite the advisors to comment or ask questions. Okay.
Maybe so, we're very clear.
So
along the way. So thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Carol. And just as a comment from me to the advisors, if any of the advisors, both my state colleagues as well as those in the private sector, have a particular interest in participating in this early, and helping shape what we do here, we'd be very interested. And you can reach out to me or to anybody on the CedarBridge team if you have that interest. As Carol mentioned, eventually this is going to come around to all the state agencies in one form or the other. But we're very interested in getting people who have a genuine interest or involved very early. So please let us know. Okay, thank you, Carol, for that. Very, very nice pinch hitting. And at this point, we want to introduce conversation around some of the work sponsored by the Office of Health Strategy in the area of primary care reforms. This, this has a history in the Office of Health Strategy, starting from the SIM program, which, as most people know, that 5-year grant ended earlier this year. But the work in primary care was so important that OHS has decided to take that up and continue to try to move an agenda forward there. So with that, I'll introduce Don Ross, also from CedarBridge, and he'll give you at least an initial introduction to what we're working on there. So Don, over to you.
Hi, good afternoon, members of the advisory. I'm happy to be with you today to talk a little bit about this. And as Alan said, there's been a lot of work in Connecticut on primary care and improvements in the delivery of care and in the financing of it and in the outcomes produced by it. So this project is really just a continuation of that work. and intended to build on what has come before, as well as aim at some new objectives and some new direction from the governor. So let's go ahead, Tina, and go to the first slide. So this group is working on actually right now on whether it can find a better name for itself. Vicky and the folks at OHS don't think this one is very attractive. So we'll see what comes out of that. But this one is very self-explanatory. Primary care and related reforms work group. There are some related reforms, and that is those parts of the system that that are important contributors to the outcomes, to the health outcomes for individuals and families and households. It does involve the behavioral health system, involves community-based organizations that provide social services as well. And they are connected to this work. So there are 32 members. They represent provider organizations, employers, consumers, and payers, and community-based organizations. And they're all really engaged and actively participating and contributing to this. We did have our first meeting in September, and we heard substantive comment, concern, and hopes from almost every single one of those 32 people. Next slide. Thank you. So the mission is to align Connecticut around its proven capabilities, look at some flexible options for model to support patient-centered and convenient access to care delivered effectively and efficiently and cost-effectively. The idea early on will be there to be a sort of a menu of options, flexible models. We know that there are different kinds of primary care clinics, many different kinds that fall into several buckets, but you've got your private practice and smaller, even solo practice docs. You've got physicians that are part of an integrated health system. You've got the community health centers, which is a whole nother model. And our experience at Cedar Bridge is that if you meet providers where they're at, and everybody is sort of on a different glide path in their evolution towards value, then that's the best way to be successful. So another objective here is to advise the Office of Health Strategy on a health enhancement community initiatives. Some of you may have familiarity with the HECs. That was another prior initiative to address upstream interventions affecting health and well-being. And so again, this is not about, this is about learning from the HEC initiative that not all health outcomes are a result of healthcare services that are delivered. These have to do with people's psychosocial and socioeconomic conditions that drive a lot of their health or lack thereof. And then also, this group's work is partly in response to Governor Lamont's Executive Order Number 5, and it coordinates with the cost growth and quality benchmarks and primary care target initiatives technical team, whose report is out now, and the Stakeholder Advisory Board. This is all about implementing strategies for increasing primary care spending. So these all of these groups are working sort of in parallel under the oversight of the Office of Health Strategies. And Executive Order Number 5 specifically addresses increased investment in primary care as a percentage of total spend, with the goal of getting it to 10% by 2025. Hey, Tina. This is just an infographic that that will sort of ping everyone's recollection to some of the other initiatives that have focused on primary care improvement, Consumer Advisory Board, moving to Value Alliance, the SIM work that Alan mentioned. Medicaid Assistance Program Oversight Council, the Primary Care Modernization.
Was tearing down.
So this takes, as well as the Practice Transformation Task Force and Population Health Council, and it all feeds into this. In fact, some members of this primary care and related reforms work group also served in those other advisory groups and councils. Okay, Tina? Next slide, thank you. So these are the steps that are planned for this. We're in step one right now. So we are talking to the group. We had the first meeting in September. The next one's coming up the end of this month. And we're talking about the priorities from getting input from stakeholders on the priorities and readiness of the system for various types of models that might be considered. And we're going to draft a roadmap based on their input, both from these meetings and the information that we lay in front of them. The roadmap will also be based on a review of all the prior initiatives, what was learned from those, what was implemented, what has been successful, and what people think has not been successful about those. And then put all that, as well as their responses, to an extensive survey that we administered, that we're performing the analysis of the data collected on that right now. And then put a draft roadmap together for their feedback and finalization. That roadmap would inform the next step, step two, that you can see in this slide, which is about putting a strategic and detailed plan together for execution. And then you would move to technical assistance and developing readiness of providers and the system to implement whatever model is chosen, and then an implementation phase after that. Okay, Tina, thanks. Next slide. So this just breaks out step one a little bit more. The idea and the product, the output that we're hoping to get from step one is a consensus-based roadmap. We do understand that different stakeholders in the system have different priorities, right? So there will be compromises to be made for the good of the people of Connecticut around that. Our experience is you don't always see payers and consumers and providers completely in agreement about what ought to occur. So since they're all represented on this work group, we're working towards a consensus on that. As I said, previous planning and stakeholder input is incorporated into what we're collecting right now. This will provide for detailed strategic planning, ability for the primary care investment and the transformation model, and to include assessment of readiness of providers, payers, agencies, and community partners, and support the implementation of new model or models if it ends up being an option. And also those can be piloted and then scaled up. And that may be the direction the group decides to go towards the goal of 10% primary care as a percentage of total spend in 2025. The other thing that we've been really emphasizing with the work group is that the end game is an improvement in primary care access and quality, leading to better health outcomes. The end game is not the payment model. The payment model is a vehicle for getting to the improved primary care. So the reason payment model changes need to be considered is depending on the preferred model for delivery of primary care and improving it, certain things that you want to do with that are not possible unless you change the payment model to support it and have those financial incentives aligned with the outcome and quality incentives that you have settled on. So next slide, Tina. So as I mentioned before, this sort of reiterates some of what we've already talked about and blows up step one a little bigger. Reviewing existing materials, and analyzing our survey data that's coming back, talking to the stakeholders at these meetings, and we're also conducting one-on-one interviews. We've already completed several of those with work group members so that we can talk one-on-one with them at length about their priorities, concerns, and preferences, and then develop the roadmap itself, and then put that out there for everyone to react to and give feedback on, and then finalize it. Next slide, Tina. So again, in the entire sort of sequencing of this work, this shows where we're at. We're in the middle of engaging the members of the work group. That's what we began at the September meeting on the 22nd. In October, we're going to share a lot of what we've learned from our analysis and review and report out on the survey data and go over a version of the charter and bylaws for the work group that have been reviewed and edited multiple times by OHS staff, by Cedar Bridge group personnel, and by the work group members who all are having a chance to review those now. So we'll vote on those. And I believe we're also going to choose a chair for the work group and vice chair at the October meeting. Next slide. And that's all on that project that I have for you today. And I'm happy to take any questions or listen to any comments that any of you have.
Thank you, Don. I have a question, which is really just to help the advisors understand the breadth of what this program's about. Can you speak a little bit to what the current percentage of primary care spend is, so the advisors can get a sense of how much the team is thinking about trying to move the needle?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alan, and I don't have that figure with me at the moment. I do not recall if Vicki had mentioned what it's currently at or not. I do know that that 10% is not as aggressive a goal as ultimately some might shoot for. There are some states that have 20 and up percentage goals for primary care as a percentage of total spend. I will have to get back to you on what Connecticut's current spend is. Actually is in, it's in the benchmark and cost growth report that was just released by that technical team. I just don't have it up.
Any comments or questions from the advisors?
See, we've got one in the chat window. How does patient-centered medical home fit into this work? PCMH was a primary care transformation model. So this work should not undo anything that was accomplished or implemented as part of the medical home work. This would be an expansion of it and really is probably gonna end up being more about primary care's connections to the rest of the system and also any pathways to improvement in access and quality of care that could be supported by a new reimbursement models. Patient-centered medical home in and of itself didn't have reforms to the payment models, and some reforms are hard to do if the reimbursement models aren't changed, because the work that you want to do, for example, isn't funded. There's a lot of engagement, clinical experts have concluded, and studies have shown that engagement of patients in a lot of ways that don't involve a physician office visit improve outcomes a lot, whether that be community health workers or a clinical pharmacist, etc. And a lot of those services are not billable under fee-for-service models. There's no code for it, or the rendering provider has to be a licensed provider and that kind of thing. So modifying the methods of reimbursement make some of this activity that results in better outcomes possible to fund and possible for clinics and systems to gear up their capacity. And we have somebody looked up the number. Thank you, Thomas. The report that I mentioned that came out of the technical team of the cost growth benchmark group is the best estimates are 4.8. So this would be doubling the investment in primary care.
Thank you, Don. Other comments or questions for Don?
All right, you've got our contact information there. Feel free to drop us an email or get to us through OHS if you have additional questions that occur to you after today's meeting is concluded.
Great.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, team. More to come on this one. At this point, let's roll forward. And at this point, I don't have any particular announcements to share. So let me open it up to general discussion amongst the advisors. Any topics that are on or questions on the mind of the advisors? All right, it's a quiet group today. So at this point, I think I will call for a move to adjourn. May I have a
motion? Alan, it's Lisa, so moved.
Thank you, Lisa. Is there a second?
And Patrick, a second.
Hey, Pat, thank you very much. Is anybody opposed? Hearing none, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, presenters and advisors, for joining, and members of public for listening in. And it's 2:32, and we will see you next month.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan.